When it comes to trying to wiggle out of paying for auto insurance, the creativity of some Michigan drivers seems to know no bounds. But to all those drivers who think they're getting away with auto insurance fraud, the Michigan Secretary of State has a warning. We're on to you. Secretary of State Ruth Johnson is announcing the creation of a task force to fight fraud in auto insurance all across Michigan. Secretary of State Johnson joins us now from Lansing. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Cynthia.
Tell us, how big a problem is auto insurance fraud in Michigan?
Well, we knew it was a problem, but I have to admit it's rather startling how big a problem. In 2012, I advocated for a law that passed that required insurance companies to send us information verifying policies electronically. And with that, we saw that there was a problem, so we did a one-day statewide sampling, or a snapshot, on a regular business day, July 31st, in 127 of our 131 branch offices. The other ones were closed. And what we found was amazing. We looked at every paper certificate that we got, which that day was 3,400, and in over half the counties, we found problems. 552 were invalid or fraudulent. That's 16.1%, and the rest of us are paying for that.
This is happening all over the state. I saw one figure. Was I correct that in Chippewa County, 60% of the certificates were fraudulent?
Yes, it's Upper Peninsula, Lower Peninsula, and all over the state. That day, over half the counties had substantial invalid and fraudulent insurance certificates. And they're anywhere from somebody trying to game the system, they use a little whiteout or do something to try to not have to pay insurance. But we've also found this very sophisticated, elaborate schemes that seem very organized. I mean, we had one person who advertised fake insurance on Craigslist. He's been charged by the Eaton County prosecutor. He faces possibly, if he's found guilty, up to 15 years in prison. We had 32 people turn in fake insurance certificates with an official-looking QR computer code on it so you can use your smartphone to read it. But when you scan it, it takes you to a document that reads, "Llamas are so cool." Somebody even set up a fake help desk so that when our staff called to verify the insurance, the fake help desk said, "Oh, yeah, that person has insurance. That's correct." And luckily, our staff is very astute. They called the corporation to make sure the insurance corporation, their head office, and found out that it was a fake. We've had former insurance agent using old company's forms. And recently, we had a car dealership selling phony policies, so we worked hard with law enforcement to close that dealership down. And the cost to Michiganians is just incredible. It has grown from 47% in 2007 to 2011. So all of the honest people of this state that are paying extra money on their insurance equals $220 million in 2012 to cover people that aren't insured.
So this is what you'd become aware of, because I'd wondered, why were you digging into this problem now? Clearly, you were aware of it. You did the action in 2012 to try to get that safety check, if you will, electronically from insurance companies. So you'd become aware that this was a growing problem.
We did, just watching how much the statewide fund that we have to all pay into settle claims from accidents when no one has insurance has risen at dramatic rate. But what we didn't know is the sophistication of some of these, and we're really cracking down. We're aggressively suspending registrations where there's invalid or fraudulent certificates. And in 2011, that was 431. Today, we've done, this year, more than 10 times that. And we are working on our FAIR initiative, the task force. We're going after people that are cheating the system and cheating their neighbors. Can you imagine thinking that you've bought insurance, doing everything right, and then when you have a claim, an accident, you find out you have no insurance? It can be economically devastating for people.
I'm wondering, as you talk to your counterparts in other states, is this happening as much in other states?
I can't say it's happening as much in most of the other states. The guesstimate is that Michigan is the seventh worst in the nation for insurance scams, so for cars. So we are going to stop it with this FAIR initiative. We are going at these kinds of problems with great zeal because we know it impacts every person in Michigan. It drives up the cost. It's really unfair to rip somebody off. And it's unfair to say you have insurance when you don't and make your neighbors pay for your insurance by way of an extra fee that goes into the statewide fund to cover those accidents to the tune of $220 million a year.
Why is it you think we're seventh worst in the nation?
You know, I'm not sure why we're one of the worst, but I can tell you this, that number's going to change dramatically with what we're doing, and we are going to keep going. We'll never stop until these people are stopped.
I have to wonder aloud, could we not make an argument that the real root of this fraud is the high rate of auto insurance, that money is always behind everything? Is it past time for state leaders to tackle the problem of the high rate of auto insurance that drivers all over Michigan are feeling?
You know, what's interesting is even where insurance is the very lowest cost in the state, you still have this kind of fraud going on. What we do know is if we don't tackle this fraud now and get it nipped in the bud, is that we'll all be paying more and more and more that are honest into this fund. I know the legislature's looking into some other ideas now, but as long as we have people cheating even in some of the lowest cost areas, we're all paying for it, and those prices are going to continue to escalate, and it's simply not fair.
Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit and its unique role in the world of design. That's what organizers are focusing on this week with the Detroit Design Festival. The five-day festival rolls out tomorrow with 70 separate events representing nearly 400 artists and designers. Matt Clayson joins us now. He's the director of the Detroit Creative Corridor Center, DC3, which organizes the festival. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you have said that you want to show how design informs the city and how the city informs design. Tell us, what do you mean by that?
Some of the most relevant design that has occurred over the past 100 years has really come from places with deep tension and deep challenges that designers and creatives have a desire to find solutions for. And so I think that the current situation in Detroit, the current narrative, really helps develop a body of fiercely independent design that is solving community needs while at the same time having a certain sort of international cliche or relevance that is really, you know, getting people to think twice about Detroit and its role in this global community that we're in.
What is it about deep tension and deep challenges that kind of drives design?
Tension and challenges present a need for solutions. And design is all about solutions. It's all about creating something beautiful or functional that meets a human or a community need for which there may be a market for.
Now, when you use the word design and designers, to a lot of this, autos come to mind if you grew up in Southeast Michigan. But really, what kinds of designers are you talking about with the Detroit Design Festival?
Well, it's a bit of everything. I mean, Southeast Michigan is home to more industrial and commercial designers than anywhere else in the country. And we also have the highest concentrations of such as a percentage of the total workforce. So you know, industrial, transportation, commercial design runs really deep here. At the same time, though, it goes beyond that. We have graphic designers, we have architectural design, and there's advertising design. And you know, Detroit and Southeast Michigan is home to one of the highest concentrations of advertising designers and advertisers in the world too. And so that's on display. Then, you know, going out of, let's say, the very commercial design side, there's just this, you know, I referenced before, this fiercely independent design community here, which I don't think they really classify themselves as industrial or a graphic designer. They're designing more so solutions for community needs and solutions that get people thinking differently about the urban environment in Detroit and possibly getting people to see a lot of the, you know, realized and untapped potential that exists here.
I'm talking with Matt Clayson, who is the director of the Detroit Creative Corridor Center, DC3, which is organizing the big Detroit Design Festival, which is rolling out Wednesday. 70 separate events representing nearly 400 artists and designers. Matt, I have to ask you this. There have to be those who wonder aloud just what difference a festival like this makes in the day-to-day lives of Detroiters when you're forced to live with bars on your windows because you're so worried about neighborhood crime and you call 911 and you don't know when and if a police car is going to respond. What does a creative festival like this really mean to those people?
A lack of city services shouldn't equate a lack of beauty. And it still, you know, helps Detroiters realize that this is a especially unique place we're living in, and somewhere that you know, we all have some type of connection to this place, and design is one piece of that. Now, mind you, that's obviously not going to solve any of these really deep, real issues that you've talked about. Mm-hmm. This is one small piece of a much more complex puzzle, a much more complex narrative that will hopefully, you know, in the near term, midterm, and long term, begin to address some of these very real, serious issues of livability.
It strikes me, too, if you're someone who wants to try to make a living through design, Detroit's got so it's kind of like the frontier. The frontier is open to you, isn't it?
In some ways. I mean, I think kind of drilling it down to we're just, you know, going outside of the design sector. We're just beginning to appreciate buying our design and creative services locally. And buying them from Detroit-based and Southeast Michigan-based businesses. And that's creating a really unique opportunity in the marketplace because, you know, for many early-stage startup designers, there's a lot of first, second, third client experiences that they can get here to build the revenues necessary to create a pretty, you know, pretty robust practice. And it's fun work that they're working on, too. So we have one of the interior design firms that we've worked with. They're doing work for the DIA, for major advertising agencies, and that's work that a startup firm in a New York or a San Francisco or a London or Milan probably wouldn't get. And so it's the type of work, the quality of work, and the type of revenues coming from it, which is, I think, helping grow our homegrown design economy here and serving as a net attractor for people from around the world to come to participate in this.
Matt Clayson's the director of the Detroit Creative Corridor Center, which is organizing the Detroit Design Festival. The full schedule for the Detroit Design Festival is on their website, and we have put a link to it on our website at michiganradio.org. Matt, good luck, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Now let's talk art. Have you noticed for every time Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr declares there are no plans to sell off DIA treasures to satisfy creditors, he then says all options are on the table. Detroit Institute of Arts officials are leaving no stone unturned as they work to protect its collection from the storm of Detroit's bankruptcy. We got to wondering, with the art world's attention focused on the DIA, how are other art museums in Michigan faring? And just how are they drawing in visitors in this digital age when most of us can look at priceless art images with just a few clicks of a mouse? Joining us for this discussion is Bridge magazine contributing writer Nancy Derringer. Her recent piece in Bridge had the hopeful headline, "Far from bankrupt, Michigan art museums thrive despite economic woes." Nancy, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me, Cindy.
And joining Nancy is the director of the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts. A pleasure to welcome Jim Bridenstine.
Thank you.
Good to have you both with us in Talking Art. Nancy, I want to start with you. You checked out the health of art museums all over Michigan. How would you grade their collective health and vitality?
Well, if people like Jim are to be believed, they're generally doing pretty well. They certainly went through a rough patch during the recession, and I think Jim was one who had to take some pretty hard hits, and you know, in his compensation and for his employees and so forth. But they seem to have come through it okay. None have had to close, none have had to, you know, curtail hours or anything like that. You know, I think a lot of people, from some of the commentary, the casual commentary that I hear surrounding the DIA's problems, a lot of people don't seem to really understand how art museums work, and they're all different. They don't have massive budgets, generally speaking, and so I think they were able to come through the, you know, the worst of the recession and emerge on the other side in fairly good shape.
Jim's headed the KIA since 1990, right, Jim?
That's right, long time.
And you've
had ups and downs for almost 25 years.
I'm particularly interested in the steps you had to take during the recession to kind of roll with those punches. Talk a little about what you had to do.
You know, when the Great Recession began, we were having a major exhibition on loan from the New Orleans Museum of Art, Masterworks, and we had great expectation for income with people, you know, buying the tickets for the show or buying works at the catalogs and so forth. And it just didn't happen. And so for 6 months into my fiscal year, I had about a $1.2 million deficit and a $4.2 million budget. Oof. So we had to do something. My two goals, which I said to Nancy, were that nobody's going to lose their job and no one's going to lose health insurance and everything else is on the table. So we eliminated things, travel, cut back on this, staff members, their match for retirement was eliminated. People took a pay cut, and I think, Cindy, I came up with a concept which I hadn't heard of before, but everybody took the first number of their annual salary. So the maintenance man is making $12 an hour, makes $24,000 a year. He took 2%. Curator making $45,000 took 4%. I took the biggest, obviously. And you know, we got through that. You know, I had a staff member, a maintenance man, come to me and say, well, why don't we sell that, pointing to our famous Helen Frankenthaler painting in the lobby. And I said, you know, Neil, if we do that this year, the next year, and I pointed to the Calder Mobile hanging from the lobby ceiling, and I said, no, that goes, and that goes, and we can't do that. And he understood, and everybody understood that we're not selling artwork to make, you know, balance the budget sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got through that year. We've, you know, things have gotten better and better in terms of how we're supported, earned income, development activities, and endowment income. And those three components really provide the funding that, you know, basically supports the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts.
Can we all acknowledge at this point what a great boss Jim was?
Yeah.
he took the biggest pay cut of the entire
staff.
Well,
of course I get the biggest pay cut.
Contrast that to some of the other businesses that did the same thing during the same period. It's quite different. But anyway.
We will survive, Cindy, like any organization. We're small. We've got basically probably about 35 permanent employees, most of whom, maybe there's four or five that are part-time, rest or full-time. And we've got a lot of faculty that are part-time and, you know, temporary. But with, you know, we're a small group, as I've been described by board members and others, you know, you run the place like a family. Mm-hmm. Well, I do run it like a family, not like a business. And yet we have business-like approach to everything we do. And, you know, we've been pretty successful running it that way.
That was Jim Bridenstine speaking. He is the director of the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts, and he is joined for this conversation by Bridge Magazine contributing writer Nancy Derringer, who wrote a piece in Bridge recently looking at Michigan's art museums and their collective health. And Nancy, what are some of the other museums in Michigan that caught your eye?
Well, obviously, you know, the DIA is probably, you know, the crown jewel of the state. And but, you know, the last question I asked Graham Beal before we concluded our interview is, you know, besides yours, what do you think is the best? And he named Kalamazoo. He also...
it didn't cost me anything, too, for him to do that.
Yeah, I would also single out Flint. I was really touched. I'm not a Michigan native. I've lived here about 8 years. And I had never heard the story of the Flint Cultural Center before. And, you know, this idea that this solidly blue-collar city, you know, once had this movement to improve, you know, everyone's experience with art and beauty by establishing this cultural center, that was one that really kind of touched me. I would really like to visit the Flint Institute of Arts at some point. Grand Rapids is probably another one that is a must-see. They had a new building in 2007. They're a big part of the art prize scene over there when art prize is going on. And they're, you know, I think the director said they have a park that's they're adjacent to that's designed by Maya Lin. They're right in the heart of downtown. So I think that would be another one that I would want to see. And then, of course, if you like contemporary, you have to go to the Broad Museum in East Lansing.
Where the building itself is a work of art.
Yes, very avant-garde. So...
We've talked about weathering the financial downturn. Jim, what's the challenge for the director of an art museum to get people to come through the doors in an age when anyone could boot up their laptop and click, 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 and you've got images and information right there in their lap? What do you do with the museum experience?
Well, we're I think, basically unique in the state of Michigan in that our mission – and we'll be 90 years old next year, is twofold. One is to promote the creation of art, which we have a school, which is community-based. I had over 3,000 students last year who took classes here. And we offer over 300 classes and, you know, every medium from, you know, weaving and jewelry to painting and printmaking, ceramics and so forth. So you've got an incredible number of people who come to the Art Institute to be able to do something with their hands and their head that they can't do on a laptop. Then this sort of supports the second half of our mission, which is the appreciation of art. We have an excellent series of exhibitions. We just closed the West Michigan Area Show, which is works by artists. It was juried, and we had about 130 works from about 700 submitted from Grand Rapids, Muskegon, you know, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, all West Michigan, basically. So you have exhibitions, and then there's also a wonderful permanent collection that is growing. And in fact, we're opening a show this week of recent acquisitions, almost 100 new works that we've acquired in the last couple of years. People are anxious to see what's new, what's different, what's exciting. And, you know, when every work of art on the screen looks the exact same size, it doesn't compare with walking in and saying, oh, my God, I didn't think it was that big or that small or, you know, that realistic or, you know, how that, you know, that abstract, I have to be there and I'm just sort of, you know, I'm just surrounded by this work, that Frankenthaler I'm thinking of in our lobby. I mean, you stand in front of it and your peripheral vision from left to right is completely enclosed in this painting. So, I mean, there's just, you know, wonderful things, wonderful tours, wonderful programs. People do get involved. People do come. They support it as a community, part of our community, but our visitors, you know, we have them from states all over the country that will come because this institution is, once they've come, I believe, they think and see that it's better than they thought it was when they came. And that keeps people here by word of mouth for what the programs and activities that we offer.
Nancy Derringer, your review of the State's Art Museums found something that I thought, well, speaking of rolling with the punches, that the DIA's attendance has actually been helped by all the headlines?
Oh, yeah. They're packing them in. I mean, you know, it's hard to separate out what the publicity over the, you know, the bankruptcy did, as well as the fact that it's now free to residents of Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County, free admission. But then I think there's no question that all the publicity has sent people flocking to the place.
Jim Bridenstine, have you seen any splashover, if you will, in the fact that the state is talking about art museums and art collections? Have you seen any spillover for you?
Well, I'd have to say that dozens of people have said to me, what do you think about what's happening in Detroit? I worked as a curator at the Detroit Institute of Arts for 10 years, and so I know Detroit. I know the collection fairly well, and I explained to them that, you know, I hope and certainly pray that nothing happens to anything in the collection. I did point out that the governance is very different from the museum in Detroit and the museum in Kalamazoo, which is like most museums, I believe. They are, you know, they're privately supported by members who, as members, contribute and from the grants and, you know, if you have an endowment and so forth that support the institution. I mean, no, that's true. Grand Rapids, for example. And, you know, people are coming. They're enjoying our collection. I think it's raised the awareness in people's minds that, you know, the importance of art museums and that there are some incredible works of art in these museums that you can go and see for free that, you know, they, you know, hadn't heard about before, didn't think about. You know, it's amazing.
Jim Bridenstine is the director of the Kalamazoo Institute of Arts, and he was joined by Nancy Derringer, Bridge Magazine writer. And thanks to both of you for a great conversation on art museums in Michigan.
Thank you. And Cindy, do come visit us. I'll give you a behind-the-scenes tour. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's the dilemma that service groups all over Michigan are facing. Funding is withering even as the need for services is growing. We wanted to see how these budget cuts are hitting service groups, what the cost has been in terms of the help they're able to offer their communities, and what strategies they've come up with to help close that gap. Joining us is Barbara Neese-May. Barbara's the executive director of the Safe House Center in Ann Arbor. It's the only place in Washtenaw County that focuses on helping survivors of domestic and sexual violence. Barbara Neese-May joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What are the reasons behind the budget shrinking?
There are several reasons. To begin with, it's a lower priority in the federal government spending priorities, which is really unfortunate. I mean, in the end, we're saving lives and building community, which is, in the end, what a lot of communities want to do so that they can say this is a wonderful place to live.
So you've lost money from the federal government, from the Department of Housing and Urban Development that you once counted on.
Yes, yes. And also sequestration has taken a major impact, plus the cost of doing business, which while we're not for profit, we're still a business.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of doing business has increased. So this has kind of turned into a perfect storm of loss of funding, flat funding in other areas, but then the cost of doing business has gone up. And it's an equation for disaster if we're not willing to, but we are willing to rise to the challenge and see what we can do to raise the much-needed funds in our communities.
I'm speaking with Barbara Neese-May, who's the executive director of the Safe House Center in Ann Arbor that focuses, in the only place in Washtenaw County, focusing on helping survivors of sexual and domestic violence. Are you finding, as you talk to your counterparts around Michigan, are other safety net organizations being hit with the same crunch?
Absolutely. I am part of a network of programs throughout the state, and we are all facing the same budget crunch.
Mm-hmm.
We're not any different than any other program in the state.
Tell us, how does Safe House Center work with domestic violence survivors to help them?
Well, at Safe House Center, we serve over 5,000 women, children, and some men who have experienced sexual assault or domestic violence in every year, and that's just for Washtenaw County. And the way we do that is through several of our programs. To begin, we have a 24/7 helpline that anybody can call any time of day to get information on how to better understand their situation or get out of the situation. Additionally, we have safe shelter, counseling programs, legal advocacy in the court systems, as well as support groups.
So it's a big array of services. With how much in terms of staff and volunteers?
Well, we have about 24 staff, but this is the astounding statistic that I think people are blown away by every time I tell them. We have more than 150 active volunteers at any given time participating in our direct services work, also doing some of the behind-the-scenes work. We are extraordinarily blessed at Safe House Center to have the volume of volunteers that we have. It far outpaces, I think, a lot of other programs.
So that, I'm sure, has been helpful as funding pressures have increased.
Absolutely. To bring in professionals from the community has had several impacts. To begin with, of course, our budget has been reducing over the last several years, and we've been able to maintain some of our critical services, all of our critical services, because of the efforts of volunteers. It also demonstrates the buy-in from the community, because there are people who are working side by side with us saying, hey, this is critical work, and we're saving lives, and we get to be a part of it.
So, strategies. What you say, you've not had to cut back on services. You certainly credit your many faithful volunteers, but you've had to probably get very creative and finding strategies to get around this budget crunch.
That's true. And this coming fiscal year, which starts October 1, is going to be our toughest year ever. We have doubled our fundraising goal. It is far in excess of $500,000, which is a very bold and courageous and faithful step that we're taking as an organization in our community, that the community is going to choose to keep these services in the community. We do have some plans and strategies behind that and some amazing partnerships that has led us to believe that we can make a difference. For example, there is a local shop called Arbor Motion.
Mm-hmm.
What they do for us is that they have what's called the Change Your Oil, Change Your Life campaign. And for a $35 or more donation to Safe House Center, they do an oil change, winter inspection, and a car wash. The funds come straight to Safe House Center. We have the opportunity to steward those folks so that they can know that what we do and what they've contributed to. And Arbor Motion has an incredible following because they support Safe House Center in this extraordinary way. And it's raised well over $30,000 or $40,000 in its first few years. It's an amazing program.
So you're looking to these public-private partnerships as a way to help close the gap.
Absolutely.
What kinds of challenges do you foresee ahead for all safety net organizations in Michigan? If you're looking down the road over the next year or two, what do you think the big challenges will be?
Federal funding is going to disappear.
And how much federal funding was a part of your budget?
When I started at Safe House, gosh, it'll be 11 years ago, mm-hmm. it was better than half of our budget. And it is going to dwindle to about a third of our budget.
You don't see that coming back.
I just don't see it returning. I think some folks think that the tide is going to come back. And while I am an optimist, I'm a realistic optimist, I believe that it will. We have to make our own way back. I don't see how that in our current economic cycle, and this is almost going to be that economics lesson, you know, just because we've had a downturn doesn't mean that in 5 years people are going to be ready to spend again. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. I mean, those cycles can take 20 to 30 years to right themselves. And I really think that we're going to need to say we're going to need to do more with less, and we're also going to need to do more fundraising in our communities and pitched into our communities. This is a critical service. We are saving lives, and this is why you should be interested and involved. I don't think it's only for programs for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. I think it's all nonprofits. I can't imagine that any nonprofit really believes that federal funding is going to save them.
What drives you? What has impelled you to embrace the cause and the needs of the survivors of sexual and domestic violence?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. We all know someone who's experienced domestic violence or sexual assault. We've all had experiences. I am a survivor. And I really believe in what if you give survivors just the few tools to level the playing field, they can take off in their own lives and contribute. And I believe that about myself, and I believe that about every single survivor that comes in. And ever since I started this career almost 20 years ago, what has been the most humbling piece of it for me is that every single person that walks through our doors, they have hope. They have been through so much. They've been through the terror and the trauma and the abuse, and they really believe their lives can be better. And that to me is absolutely stunning, and it's a gift. And so if we can't say that we can be there for them, but we will be, and that's what I believe in.
And you've lived it in your life.
I've lived it in my life.
Barbara Niesmay, the executive director of the Safe House Center in Ann Arbor, and she was kind enough to join us here in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There is a specific job shortage in Michigan, and this is the kind of job that can impact the cost of doing business, job growth, and ultimately the cost of the goods that you buy. The job shortage? Truckers. There just aren't enough drivers for those big rigs. What's behind this shortage? What does it mean to you, the consumer? And what kinds of job opportunities exist for workers looking to reinvent themselves? Writer Ted Rolos reported on the driver crunch in a piece for Bridge Magazine with what might be one of the best titles ever, Breaker Breaker 1-9, Trucking Jobs Dying on the Vine. Ted joins us now from Kentwood. And Ted, just why are truck driver jobs dying on the vine in Michigan?
Well, I think you're looking at, in terms of the shortage of truck drivers, both nationally and in Michigan, there's a couple things happening simultaneously. You've got a lot of baby boom truck drivers, just like in a lot of other occupations. They're starting to cycle out of the job, and there's not enough younger drivers taking their place. And on top of that, you've got a high attrition rate within the industry where, especially on the younger end of new hirees, they tend to burn out and leave the occupation often in less than a year. And that has a lot to do with the rigors of if you come on as a inexperienced truck driver, no years on the road, uh-huh. having graduated from one of these driving schools, you're likely to end up with a long-haul national firm where you're going to be on the road sometimes 4, 5, 6 weeks, and that's pretty tough. So that all that kind of folds into an ongoing issue, both for Michigan and nationally, and the projections indicate it's going to get worse.
And we're talking, Ted, about what, the long-haul drivers more than the short-haul?
No, I think it's, you know, it's hard to separate one from the other, but the long-haul national firms, those are the ones that are experiencing the greatest turnover rate. And that's in my discussion with some of these regional Michigan-based firms. The reason for that is the regional firms generally require 2 years of a clean driving record as a truck driver before you can be hired, as opposed to, as I indicated earlier, say you're a 21-year-old person looking for work, you decide to go to one of these truck driving schools, which costs somewhere in the order of $4,000 to get your commercial driving license. At that point, it's tough to get hired by a regional firm because they want that over-the-road experience. So then you end up with a national long-haul firm, and as I indicated, those tend to be the long weeks away from home kind of jobs. So we're talking about actually all those things. So the regional firms are having the same issues with attracting and retaining drivers. I talked to a firm in Kent County that they'd like to buy 3 new trucks. They want to expand their business, but they're waiting because they can't. They don't have the drivers right now to fill those trucks. So
it strikes me from what you're saying that this is the kind of position that can really impact right along the supply chain, right to the point of affecting the goods that we want to buy.
That's true. I'd found an estimate by a research national research firm in 2012 that the freight rates were going up by 2 to 5% because of the shortage of drivers. And, you know, it's the same law of economics that applies to other services and goods as well. It's, you know, the old supply and demand issue, and demand being higher than supply. At some point, you're going to, companies are going to be forced to pay more to retain, to hire these drivers. And in addition, while you have these delays in shipping, with just-in-time shipping, any half day lost, any day lost, is an expense to a company, and ultimately that's going to be passed on down through the chain. It's going to eventually reach us as consumers.
What do industry insiders, Ted, say needs to happen to solve this driver shortage?
Well, the answer that I hear most consistently is that if you've got an issue with supply, you don't have enough drivers, then you're going to have to do something to change that, which at the company end has to be, you have to do what it takes to hire that driver, you have to do what it takes to retain that driver, which is going to be pay more, offer better benefits, offer a more supportive culture, that sort of thing. And at some point, I think if the shortage is severe enough, it's just there's going to have to be a response by transportation firms and by corporations.
How much credence is the industry giving to the technology of driverless vehicles? Are they seriously looking at automated trucks?
Well, it's interesting. I had more than one person mention that to me as I was working my way through the research on this, and I was pretty skeptical, and then I started looking into it more. And what really kind of caught my eye was a lawyer who's maybe regarded as one of the most prominent national transportation litigators. He does a lot of these trucking cases, and he's absolutely convinced that we're going to see autonomous trucks. You can't put a year on it, but he's positive it's going to happen within, say, 20, 30 years. And this means a truck going down the road without a driver, which sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But there's already, you know, there are autonomous cars being tested right now that drive themselves. They do have a driver in the vehicle, but they actually drive themselves. And we're getting closer and closer to that. You know, we now have cars that park themselves and
sure.
Cars that will automatically brake if there's an object ahead of you or behind you that you don't see. So it's not implausible. I think there would have to be an incredible culture shift before that's going to happen. But as this lawyer indicated, if you look rationally at all the crashes that happen with people behind the wheel, it's not as if human beings are perfect drivers. So there's certainly room for discussion in that.
That's a very, very good point. It certainly does strike me that there are many opportunities then if you're a worker in Michigan who needs and wants to reinvent himself or herself, there are opportunities there, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. There are jobs to be had. There are people eager to hire truck drivers. Someone without experience is going to have to go to a driving school. They're typically somewhere on 3 to 4 weeks. There's going to be over-the-road experience. You have to pass a written test, and you have to pass a skills driving test. At that point, you are marketable, and you will be hired.
Bridge Magazine contributing writer Ted Roloffs. As always, Ted, thanks so much.
Oh, happy to do it.
Meantime, car sales in Europe for the first 8 months of this year are at their lowest level since they started keeping records in 1990, and that's despite modest economic growth. So far this year, passenger car sales in the European Union are down more than 5%. Sales here in the U.S. are faring better. Passenger car sales are on track here to reach 16 million vehicles a year, and that's the same level from before the Great Recession. And as always, we invite you to connect with us. It's easy to do. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Click on the Stateside link. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.